This is a Thinking Aloud podcast from the BBC, and for more details on our terms of use and much, much more about Thinking Aloud, go to our website at bbc.co.uk. Hello. I wonder if anyone remembers a delicious sketch by the American comedian Shelley Berman about the perils of air travel. The moment before he actually boards the plane, he decides to take out some insurance. Nothing wrong with insurance, he says, but whatever you do, don't read the actual words on the policy, because if you do, you'll come across the word maimed. And maimed, observes Berman, is a horrible word. I mean, injured conveys the meaning, but maimed, it sounds so permanent. It should be stricken from the English language. Well, decisions to strike out words can, however, be informed by rather more serious considerations than personal sensitivity. In this extract from George Orwell's 1984, Winston Smith learns from his colleague Syme about the way in which Big Brother is purging the language of concepts incompatible with the political regime of Oceania.
You're hard at work on the dictionary, I suppose?
Yes, I've reached the adjectives at last.
I can see we'll have a busy time. It becomes compulsory, learning all the new words your department's invented for us.
Well, we're not only inventing words, we're destroying them. Scores of them, thousands every day. By the year 2050, the whole literature of the past will have gone. Milton, Byron, Chaucer, they'll exist only in newspeak forms. Even the party slogans are changing. How will you say freedom is slavery when the word freedom no longer exists? The whole aim of newspeak is to narrow the range of thought.
To narrow the range of thought?
In the end, we'll make thought crime literally impossible because there'll be no words to express it.
Donald Pleasance and Peter Cushing in a 1954 BBC adaptation of Orwell's dystopian novel. It's an example quoted in a new book called Through the Language Glass, How Words Colour Your World. It's an example which, according to the author Guy Deutscher, nicely illustrates the mistaken idea that the language we happen to speak is a prison house that limits the concepts we're able to understand. Take away the concepts, goes that argument, and the thoughts conveyed by those linguistic terms also disappear. Well, to discuss the complex relationship between words and thoughts, I'm now joined by Guy Deutscher, who is an honorary research fellow at the School of Languages, Linguistics and Cultures at the University of Manchester, and by Anthony Grayling, who's professor of philosophy at Birkbeck University of London. Guy, your book, as the title suggests, explores this relationship between thinking and language. I suppose the crudest notion of the relationship, really, is that the language you speak, there is something about the way that you speak, the words, the way the words are put together, the grammar or whatever, which demands a whole way of thinking, so that German language suggests a way of thinking that is not the same as the way of thinking suggested by the English language.
That's right. Well, I think there's even a cruder way of sort of types of prejudices about language that one hears. The simplest form is that this language or the other is ugly or even vulgar, and obviously this always applies to the languages of other nations. I think the most awful things I've heard were among nations that are meant to be great friends. When I spent a year in Scandinavia as a student, I heard that in Sweden, for example, it's common knowledge that Danish is not a language but a throat infection. And even worse things were said by great thinkers in their great works. We may all think of Italian as the height of elegance and chic, but if you ask Dante, he would have told you that the language spoken by the inhabitants of Rome or the dialect was not really a dialect, but just a vile jargon. And he said this wasn't surprising because the inhabitants of Rome stand out for the ugliness of their manners and outward appearance. But when you go beyond these merely ludicrous prejudices to, I would say, creative fantasizing, this is when you start getting statements like, exactly, speaking German would necessarily make you philosophize, or speaking French immediately makes you romantic, or statements the language of a tribe somewhere is so primitive that it has absolutely no grammar and just a few grunts and groans, or the notion that if you don't have a future tense in your language, then this means you necessarily cannot understand the concept of futurity.
So we're moving away from really, as you say, the rather cruder notions that, your way of being, your whole culture is determined by the form that your language takes. I mean, towards the more, Anthony, the more sort of familiar idea that language constrains thought. If the words aren't there, I can't have the thought. I mean, we're seeing that in 1984. Get rid of the words and people can no longer think about freedom. If freedom isn't in the vocabulary, we can't have the thought.
Well, to some extent, it's true that you could argue that it's true that if you don't have a vocabulary for something, that you can't make the kinds of distinctions that the vocabulary permits. For example, if you know very little indeed about nature study or botany and you walk in the woods, you might have a wonderful poetic experience. But if you can't differentiate between oak and elm or between one kind of flower and another, if you don't have the names for them, it's possible that you might have a less discriminating experience of the things than a biologist would have.
You might not see them even because they're not marked out or they're not distinguished in language.
Well, it's likely that you might see them, but you might...
See what is a daisy, see the difference between, say, a daisy and a dandelion.
Yes, indeed, you would be less conscious of them or less acute in your differentiations of them. So in one sense, having a vocabulary permits a much finer and more discriminating kind of experience. But I take it that Guy would agree, perhaps, and something I got out of his very fine book, that you can acquire the vocabulary and therefore you can acquire the distinctions. It's simply not the case that these things are closed to you. It's not a matter of necessity, it's an entirely contingent.
Let me just pop in one thing, because many people talk about having inexpressible thoughts, don't they? I mean, they simply say, oh, good heavens, I got the feeling when I was standing there, I can't put it into words, don't ask me to explain, there are no words for it. You'd concede that the thought is possible here, but you might want to say, well, if you had words, then indeed the thought might be a more refined one?
I think that there are occasions when we can't find words for things. I mean, this happens often enough, you know, when we encounter something that in the refined manner that we sometimes say these things, gobsmacks us. we can't find a ready idiom. But I'm pretty sure that if we tried hard enough, if we made the dogged struggle that William James said is what philosophy consists in, that we could find an articulation for our thoughts.
Now, let me come to you, Guy, because we want to, let's look at this historically, because a lot of the argument about the relationship between language and thought, in recent years, brings up the name of Benjamin Lee Whorf and his 1940 study of the language of the Hopi tribe. Just tell me about what it was he claimed to find through his analysis of the language here.
Well, Whorf essentially seduced his whole generation into believing that speakers of Hopi, but the speakers of American Indian languages generally, have, just because of the language they speak, have a completely different notion of reality from ours. He used many examples, but this particular one, he claimed that the Hopi language has no words whatsoever or any expressions to express time, nor tenses. And therefore, Whorf claimed, a Hopi Indian, knowing only the Hopi language, would simply not be able to understand the concept of time as we know it.
And other people like Steiner came in and talked about the implications of this for people living in a world in which there was no future tense.
Exactly. And many people in the following decades, including Steiner, quoted Whorf almost uncritically as if this was simply mere fact and applied the same argument to a host of other languages. In Steiner's case,
But was Whorf misinterpreting the evidence that he got? I mean, how did he come to this conclusion, which you would want to suggest is completely erroneous?
To start with, Whorf was, let's say, rather cavalier with his facts. It turns out that the particular language that he was claiming was a timeless language has a very elaborate tense and aspect system, and it has dozens of different expressions for different concepts of time. Whorf never bothered to visit the Hopi tribe in Arizona. His information was based on a conversation he had with one Hopi informant who happened to live in New York City. But even... I mean, the more fundamental question is not just the fact that Whorf's facts were invented, essentially. The whole notion that simply, as we said, because you don't have a certain word in your language, this means that you are unable to understand the concept is ludicrous. And you just mentioned this before, but you can also think about it in a theoretical way. If this were true, it would mean that you would never be able to learn anything new, any new words or any new concepts.
So, I mean, it's interesting. I think you used the example of something like Schadenfreude. I mean, you know, that we may lack the word Antony, but that doesn't mean to say that it cannot be explained to us the work the world is doing and for us to therefore recognise what it's doing.
Yes, exactly right. I mean, Guy's just made the point that we wouldn't be able to learn anything new if that were the case. But it also applies across languages because, of course, there's this mythology about the fact that in some languages there is an expression which captures something that in our own language we don't capture in exactly that way. All, at most, that that means is that in our own language we need to paraphrase, we need a paraphrasis, circumlocute to express the idea there because we don't have a red idiom in our own language. So all ideas are available to all human beings, even if sometimes it takes us longer to say it than others.
Now, of course, at the other extreme, the argument is, I mean, here we're talking about the ways in which language may affect culture. We're going to go on and talk about that for another. But along come people like Chomsky, and I think we could put Steven Pinker into this, same bag, who want to say, listen, there is something universalistic about language. It's innate, it's a given, and there's really no great point in exploring differences between language and trying to read off things about culture from that. Language is a given, that's it. Now, you don't want to go along with that, do you, Guy?
No, what I'm trying to do in the book is, in some sense, to save the idea that language can actually influence the way we think from Warfianism, from the charlatanism of the past, and suggested
influence but not determine.
Exactly. Yeah. And what I try to show is that the major error that Worf made was to assume that language is a prison house, as you said, but there's absolutely no evidence for that. But if we want to look at the real influence of language on thought, we have to look at the relevant differences between languages are not in what each language allows its speakers to say, because in theory, at least, every language can express any thought, but in what different languages oblige their speakers to say. As Roman Jakobson put it, the relevant difference is not in what each language may say, but in what it must say.
So language influences thought in certain areas. And I think one of the things that you might cite is like spatial relationships. I mean, it gives us backwards and forwards and sideways, but you can find certain sorts of groups of people, certain tribes, in quotes, who actually have more elaborate systems of orientation, which you would want to say influence the way they look at the world?
Exactly. For a long time, for centuries, people thought that the way we describe spatial relations is with words like behind or in front of or left or right is universal and natural, just a sort of a fundamental building block of language and thought. But then a remote Aboriginal language from North Queensland was discovered, where people actually never use concepts like in front of or behind or left or right. Instead, they describe absolutely everything in cardinal directions, west, north, south, east.
How much do you, Anthony, want to concede to culture in this respect, or how much are you a Chomskyan or in terms of wanting to subscribe to a universal nature of language, a given nature, an innate nature, which really bends very little with culture?
Well, one has to distinguish first between the fact that obviously a capacity to use language, to be able to process language, has to be hardwired. I mean, we're all, I hope, around here of the view that the language bump on the left cerebral hemisphere in most all right-handed, most left-handed people is specific to linguistic capacity, and trauma to it makes you aphasic in one way or another. So there is some hardwiring there. It's an inherited, evolved capacity in human beings. And so something in the structure of the brain is responsible for the ability to learn any natural language if you're put into that natural language community and exposed to it early on. But then, and that's perfectly consistent with the thought that the language we, in fact, learn and the kinds of habits of thought and of speech and of emphases and of things that matter, matters of interest and focus for that culture, will be embodied in the natural language that we learn, and it will indeed shape our way of thinking about the world and responding to it. Now, these two things are perfectly consistent. The interesting question is, and I think Guy points out in his book that a lot more empirical work is needed to tease this out, and maybe it will come from some of the, you know, nearly vanishing languages in the world today, is which aspects of all languages are so universal that they reflect the hardwired aspect of language as opposed to the cultural aspect.
I love to end on a big question. That's where we'll have to end. Antony Kraling and Guy Deutscher, thank you very much. Words, words, words. If only they didn't take up so much room, then I could do better justice to your emails. But I can find space for some of your comments on the family history discussion we had 2 weeks ago. I've got space for Daniel Abrams. Laurie, listening to your discussion of genealogical research, I was reminded of a lecture by the anthropologist Mayo Fortes. He observed that there were two kinds of descent systems, one where you trace every ancestor and the other where all you needed to know was the founding ancestor. He concluded by observing, I'm descended from Aaron. And also space for Trudy Foster. Laurie, I work in an archive filled with passionate family historians, and I think you need to mention that family history also promotes social inclusion. People who find it hard to connect elsewhere can feel at home and relaxed in environments where they totally fit in. Family history goes way beyond just looking up your ancestors. Thanks, Trudy. Thanks also, Stephen Wicker and Mike Hill. And just time for words prompted by last week's discussion on black music. Ian Whitney found it very opinionated. Your guest's entire argument boiled down to the eternal complaint, music was better when I was a kid. Others like Karen Taylor found it over-intellectualised. Why didn't someone say the unsayable? Black music was way better in the 60s, 70s and 80s. Well, Elias Diamantis was worried about the disdain with which I treated hip-hop. I sincerely believe that hip-hop is the only palpable sea change in popular music in living memory. Thanks also James Ashdown, Murray Hamilton, Gordon Petherbridge. In case you have any comments, praise or abuse you'd like to heap on today's guests or their contentions, or just on me, then here are our addresses. Thinking Aloud, BBC Radio 4, Broadcasting House, London, W1A, 1AA, or you can email us at thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. And don't forget, if you want to hear the programme one more time, consult our archive, sign up for my newsletter this week, Pardon My English, or download our podcast, all you have to do is go to this pretty little website and click through bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Lots of folks back east, they say, is leaving home every day, beating a hot old dusty way to the California line. Across the desert sands they roll, getting out of that old dust bowl. They think they're going to a sugar bowl, but here's what they find. Now the police at the port of entry say, you're number 14,000 for today, oh, if you ain't...
That's Woody Guthrie chronicling the prospects and the perils of moving between different regions in the States. It's a verse which, since I heard it, suddenly reminded me of the extraordinary journey chronicled in The Grapes of Wrath, which was almost compulsory reading when I was 17. To the red country and part of the grey country of Oklahoma, the late rains came gently and they did not cut the scarred earth. I can still see those first words actually on the page. Well, all this talk of movement and migration between regions is the result of my reading a book which gives a new significance to the word region, a book which departs from the traditional concerns of social scientists and economists with the relative development of nations and instead concentrates upon the spatial inequalities which obtain within countries. It's the story, if you like, behind the existence of rich and poor places. And that book is called The Wealth and Poverty of Regions, Why Cities Matter. And its author, who now joins me, is Mario Palès, who's professor at the National Institute of Scientific Research in Montreal. Let's begin with the Industrial Revolution, shall we? I mean, it's the key moment, you want to say, really, in the creation of regional wealth differences. Could you just spell that out for me a little more?
Well, the Industrial Revolution was a break in many ways, in way of doing things. But every change, and in this case we're talking about changes in technology, every change means that some regions gain, some regions lose. Changes, every change we have. No change is geographically neutral. If tomorrow petrol, for example, ceases to be a resource, well, there goes Alberta and Canada, there goes Texas, and there goes Saudi Arabia. Every change favors some regions more than others. And the Industrial Revolution, of course, was the biggest break we have ever had in the way of doing things. And that naturally meant that some regions, some types of functioning were going to be favored over others. And that is continuing.
The title of your book is The Wealth and Poverty of Regions, subtitle, Why Cities Matter.
Exactly.
And you're talking about how large cities are almost inevitably the wealthiest regions in countries. And I think some people will wonder why, with the advent of internet and email, we were always told this would reduce the importance of place. So why does place go on being so critical?
Well, for the simple reason I'm here talking to you, is that for things which we call inventive, creative, imaginative, and that's more and more so in modern economies, even with the internet, even with all these information technologies, people need to meet and talk to each other. Okay. And the reason that even with the information technology, things continue to concentrate is because the information technology also allows you then to extend your information, actually, to go to a much greater market. Okay, look at the BBC. You're talking to me. Okay, what you're doing is concentrated here in London, but people in Singapore and Cape Town or Buenos Aires can listen to you. In other words, information technology makes it possible to concentrate certain types of activities in certain places. London could not be the financial center it is today if it were not for information technology. A person sitting in Nairobi can call up his broker in London and get something done. So in that sense, the information technology goes both ways. Yes, it allows people to do things in other places, but it also now allows one place to be able to serve the whole universe.
But you want to suggest, don't you, because, I mean, many people, as I said earlier on, have concentrated upon the wealth of nations and drawing up tables of relative income and so on. But you want to suggest the wealth of regions is rather more fragile than the wealth of nations. I mean, yes. it does actually make your book rather more dynamic because you're getting shifting importance of regions. Why?
Well, and in Europe, of course, you're living this right now, is that the difference between a region and a nation is a region, by definition, does not have an economic border. Okay, so capital and labor, especially labor, moves very freely. If things go poorly, okay, people move out and go somewhere else. Britain has been living through this for the last 50, 60 years with a movement from the north to the south. Okay, so let's say the north of England were a separate nation, had its own currency. Yeah. It could have devalued. You would have had a northern pound, which would have devalued, and it would probably, the north would have, let's say, to a certain extent, reconverted its economy. So regions have actually very little tools, to be honest. They almost have no tools to manage their own economies. They're necessarily within an integrated national unit.
And what typically produces their downfall is a decline in the particular industries on which their original strength was built. I mean, you cite Manchester as a pretty classic example here.
Manchester is, of course, the classic example because, indeed, Manchester was the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, but times changed. The industries on which Manchester were built declined, while the industries, if we may call them that, the service industries in which London was built, have been on the upswing.
But if I look in your book, there's a map here which is talking about this peculiar banana-shaped corridor, which is about regions that do maintain their success over time. I'm looking about this, which, I mean, stretches from across Britain down to northern Switzerland, covers most of Netherlands and Belgium, much of western Germany. And that has remained relatively stable in terms of its prosperity.
It's remained amazingly stable in Europe. It's that, which, again, is the same point, is as technology changes, okay, especially as communication and transportation becomes more efficient, the tendency of economies is to concentrate rather than to deconcentrate. Okay? And we see this in Europe. And the wealth within Europe continues to be very concentrated within that banana-shaped corridor.
And you can have some regions, because you've got some very nice paradoxes in your book, because you talk about the decline of the American South, and I think you want to say that the reason the American South declines after the abolition of slavery is because a plantation mentality lingers on. But now we can actually see a reversal in that region. Just explain that switch.
Well, the American case is rather particular. Okay, it's a rather particular case because also, okay, first on the slavery thing, is because one of the reasons that the South has come back up again is because of the great mobility of the American population, much more mobile than Europeans. So there was a massive movement of blacks and whites, okay, which, of course, as anybody knows in Economics 101, will have a certain equilibrating effect on salaries. But the other effect is more difficult to describe. Again, it's technology. Okay, before the South, nobody would have thought of moving to South Florida. It was full of diseases, malaria. Okay, well, today with air conditioning, like with airplanes, and with all these different improvements in sanitation, the South now has become very livable. So you can live in these hot places in Texas with your air conditioning. You can now live in Miami because you have air conditioning. Malaria has been beaten long ago, and it's no longer a dangerous place. So there's been a tremendous movement within the United States from the cold north to the south. So you put those two things together, the massive migration between the First and Second World War of the poorer populations from the south to the north. And since the Second World War, this tremendous movement from the north to the south has created a totally new south.
What is interesting, because I think you said that in the States, actually, if you look at region mm-hmm. from region, there is really, I mean, it's a surprising amount of equality between regions, I think you want to say, in the States. Because this doesn't say anything at all, does it, about inequalities in wealth? I mean, we're often talking in this programme about enormous disparities in the richest and the poorest. So your analysis doesn't really address that, does it?
No. One shouldn't confuse the two. You can have fairly equal development between regions. The United States is a good example. But within the region, within each region, you can have great inequalities between individuals or families. The two do not necessarily go together. They're two entirely different things.
And if we look at somewhere like China, where you point to very large differences between regions, as countries develop, do these dramatic differences attenuate? Do they get smaller?
Well, what history tends to show is that during the first stages of development, the disparities increase. Okay, and there in China, you have incredible disparities today. I mean, the average wages in Shanghai is 6 or 7 times the national average. But as you go over a sort of hump, one might say, when it attains a certain level of riches, then the tendency is that the disparities will then start to decrease. And that has been the general tendency. But again, there are exceptions.
A last question, because prompted in a way by reading this morning's newspapers about the coalition government, which apparently is seeking to help the regions currently dependent upon public sector jobs, where there are going to be big cuts, is going to actually try and help. One could also mention as well the BBC's recent decision to send lots of its staff up to Manchester. I mean, is it possible that these type of decisions can do anything to address the disparities which exist between regions?
They can help, but one should not overestimate the capacity of governments to really go against what one might call long-term market forces. For in the British case is indeed a rather dramatic case of regional disparities, but in this case between south and north. To really reverse that would require from the national government an effort which is simply something which is very difficult to imagine, both in terms of resources and simply in terms of consistency. It's not the sort of thing that is easy to do.
You would be pessimistic about the chance of politics making a difference?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mario Pelez. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Just while this topic of language and thought still hangs in the air, I must mention that just a recent meal I had with a rather conservative old school friend, and as the meal went on, he was becoming more and more vehemently critical of capitalism. He suddenly started to wave his knife around very aggressively. "Oh, gosh," I said, "you've changed spots." "Oh," he said, simultaneously lowering his knife and his enthusiasm. Sorry, he said, "most unexpected, the old fault. Never know what I think till I hear what I say." Well, I do hope you enjoyed that programme. And if you'd like to hear something similar, why not try downloading the In Our Time podcast at bbc.co.uk/radio4.